I don't know about you, but although I love holidays, there's just one thing I dread about them, and that's the coming home afterwards. And although I guess not a lot of it's much fun, for me the worst bit is going back to work afterwards. When I used to work in my old job down in Swindon, we used to have to go in via our mail room. So actually you could pretty well instantly tell how bad things were going to be, depending on the amount of mail which was bulging out of your pigeonhole. Now, I guess things have moved on a little bit since then, because it's a bit less obvious now, because you can get to your desk and think it looks pretty empty. And actually, I still think my instant reaction is, oh, that's okay, it's not a lot there. But I tend to forget that, of course, it's no longer the amount of post on your desk which is important. It's that little number in brackets by the inbox when you turn on your computer. Anyway, when I got back this summer, to start with, I thought it was pretty good news. I only had something like 47, I think it was, something like that, which was actually a bit of a record. And I skimmed through a lot of them, and there didn't seem to be too much to be worried about. So all was going pretty well. And then I got to this innocent-looking one at around number 32, I think it was, and it said, Charmaine Muir, lunchtime services rota. I actually almost ignored it to start with, but then I thought, oh, hang on. I guess that's got to be the preaching rota, so I'd better have a look and see what she's landed me in this term. And I knew I shouldn't have done it, as it would spoil my return from holiday, but there it was. One verse, Exodus 20, verse 14, thou shalt not commit adultery. And I thought, Charmaine, how can I possibly do justice to thou shalt not commit adultery in 17 minutes in the middle of a working day? It's just not possible. So, anyway, I thought I'd mention it to my family to see if they had any bright ideas about where to start. And other than laughing, the only real reaction I got was from my 17-year-old daughter, Sarah, who just said, well, you just say, don't do it, don't you? Which was very sound, but not a lot of help. But I hadn't really thought also about the fact that my 8-year-old, Sophie, was also in the room. And I thought she wouldn't be listening to me anyway, as she never normally does. But she then looked up from a TV program and said, Dad, what's adultery? So I ended up finding myself in an even bigger hole than Charmaine had already landed me in. Anyway, I got a bit of help a few days later when I found this article in the Evening Standard. And it's headed, Recession Blames as London is Found to be Adultery Capital. And it says, London is the UK's cheating capital, with nearly 2 out of 5 people questioned admitting affairs. The recession is being blamed, with colleagues desperate to keep their jobs, forming relationships as they spend longer together at work. Today's findings from the Relate Counselling Service show that nearly 37% of Londoners have had an affair, compared with 33.5% nationally. Relate Councillor Paula Hall said, "The recession means we're all working crazy hours. It's often in the workplace when that opportunity arises, and socialising with colleagues over a drink on the way home. A lot of work teams are pulling together harder, which happens when people are emotionally stressed. This is called trauma bonding. Often people don't want to contaminate their home environments by burdening their partners with their stresses, and London is very anonymous. It's easier to have a secret affair, whereas in a small village, everyone is likely to find out. The answer is not to put yourself in temptation's way." So, some pretty worrying statistics there, but also actually some pretty good advice from Paula Hall of Relate. I don't know how often the Evening Standard and the Bible carry the same advice, but Paula Hall's words, the answer is not to put yourself in temptation's way, isn't very far removed from what Jesus said in this passage from Matthew 5 that we've just had read from the Sermon on the Mount. He uses much more dramatic language when he talks in verses 29 and 30 about gouging out eyes and cutting off hands. But the gist of the message is the same. Don't mess around. Adultery is serious. Don't put yourself in temptation's way. So I thought if I was going to do a bit more than take Sarah's suggestion of just saying, don't do it, the only passage to frame my thoughts around is Matthew 5, as it's Jesus' most explicit reference to the subject of adultery. Having said that, I do want to put in a bit of a caveat to start with, as it seems to me that the points he's making on adultery and divorce are just a little bit in passing, as his overall concern is the subject of how he personally fits with the Old Testament scriptures. So what I thought I'd do is take a look at the two specific mentions that he makes towards adultery in verses 27 to 32, and then set the overall context of verses 17 to 20 at the end, so we can see how his message on adultery fits into the big picture. So if we start by going to verses 27 to 28, we see that Jesus kicks off by making a shocking statement. Don't think that you're not an adulterer just because you haven't slept with someone who's not your spouse. Now, I'm not sure the Evening Standard would agree with the Bible on that point. And to be honest, if you put it that starkly, I reckon a number of us here also do a bit of a double take when we hear it put like that. But he says it clearly. You've heard that it was said, do not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Now, I don't know about you, but at this point, my analytical accountancy brain says, well, hang on, Jesus, what exactly do you mean by lust? You know, we're in a big city here, not too many bigger, and there's hundreds, thousands of beautiful people all around, and there's all the advertising on the tube and the billboards, and you've given us all eyes to see and made us men and women. You know, where does observation stop and lust start? Are you saying we're all adulterers, even if we're not married? Now, I guess I could try and draw up a detailed definition and try to work out where observation stops and lust starts. But the point is that wherever you draw the line, we'll all fall over it at some point. So yes, we are all adulterers. Many of us will fall a very long way over that particular line. But Jesus doesn't stop there, because it's at that point that he gives us the advice we've already heard in verses 29 to 30. I know you've fallen over that line, and you'll continue to do so. But following me means being serious about being holy. Do whatever it takes to control yourself. So, for example, let's just take the most obvious targets. What websites are you visiting? What TV programs and films do you watch? What books do you read? What are you thinking about as you look around the sights of the city and the sights of your office? Now, I've got to say, as I say this, I feel a little bit like Ned Flanders in The Simpsons, you know, the archetypal Christian prude, or even worse, the overprotective dad who gives his teenage sons and daughters good advice, which goes in one ear and comes out of the other. Because I'm the sort of person who struggles with those arguments which surface from time to time in the church about, you know, whether it's suitable to be reading this book or watching this film. Because drawing a line in the sand is so difficult. But of course, it isn't just the lust itself which is the problem. It's where it can end up leading when it gets a foothold that can make it so devastating. You know, whether that's an addiction to pornography or a good friendship in the office or even in the church, which leads to something more. Whatever it is, it can start out as a small spark but end up as a raging fire. And I guess I'm not the only one here who's seen how terrible this can be in the marriage of really close friends. So we need to heed Jesus' words, and we need to heed Paula Hall's words. Don't put yourself in temptation's way. The dangers are all around. But Jesus then moves on from warning about the dangers of lust to some of the technicalities and legalities of divorce in verses 31 to 32. It looks a little bit complicated at first, but it boils down to saying, where there's divorce, there's adultery. Because the only place he seems to lend any support to divorce is where adultery has already happened. Now, if we've been around church for quite a while, we may not bat an eyelid at this. But if we stop to think about it, the importance that Jesus places on marriage is quite staggering. So we need to ask ourselves, why is he treating marriage as so crucial? And I guess the simple answer is for two foundational reasons. Firstly, marriage between a man and a woman is absolutely fundamental to the whole of creation. If you want to look that up, you can see that in Genesis chapter 2. And then secondly, the marriage commitment between a man and a woman is the lived out example of the commitment of Jesus Christ to the church, and you can see that in Ephesians chapter 5. So that's, in a nutshell, why marriage is seen as so important. And if you think about it, the seventh commandment, not to commit adultery, is a sort of worked out example of the first commandment of having no other gods. If you were here when Hugh Palmer introduced a series on the Ten Commandments, one of the things he said then was that the language of the first commandments was like the language of the wedding ceremony, you know, to have and to hold, forsaking all others till death us do part. And, you know, it's quite an interesting exercise if you compare the sort of things you'd look for in a good marriage and see how that should be mirrored in terms of our relationship with God. I was actually playing around with this idea when I was going on a train to Durham recently with Nate, who's our youth evangelist at Christianity Explored. I'd come up with this list of words that summed up a good marriage, such as loyalty, compassion, support, exclusivity, discipline, resisting temptation, security, and so on. It was quite funny. It was only right at the very end when I thought of things such as fun and excitement and flowers and chocolates. I'm sure my wife would have quite a lot to say about what that says about me, not least about the fact that flowers actually made it into my list at all. But Nate pointed out that it was quite interesting that the bits which are often the lure for the adulterous relationship, I'd almost forgotten about, as I was thinking about things which were the bedrock of a good marriage. You know, these other things, they're more like the icing on the cake. Now, please don't mishear me on this, because I'm not saying that these things aren't important to a marriage. I'd suggest that the more fun and excitement there is in a marriage, the less likely it is that one partner will go looking for it elsewhere. But realistically, there are going to be times in a marriage where the fun and excitement are in limited supply, because we all know that life isn't always a bed of roses. Yet that doesn't mean that the marriage is dead. Far from it. And just as a little parallel in terms of our relationship with God, if you're expecting a lifelong commitment to Jesus to be one high after another, then think again. It ain't like that. Yes, there should be fun and excitement in our relationship with Jesus. It's actually as important in our relationship with him as it is in a marriage. But again, realistically, there'll be times that it's in very limited supply. And again, just because you may feel very little, it doesn't mean your relationship with God is dead. Far from it. It's for life, just like marriage. So marriage matters. It's for life. Where there's divorce, there's adultery. So if we're told not to commit adultery, we shouldn't get divorced. And yet, even as I say this, I can hear you all coming up with all sorts of questions, just as the crowd would have had all sorts of questions for Jesus 2,000 years ago. Yeah, it might start with things like, well, what about if there's a forced marriage, for example, or violence even? And it could then work its way through to, well, what if we can't talk to each other without shouting? Or even, well, what if they claim there's nothing going on and, yeah, his secretary knows more about what he's feeling than I do? You know, and then, of course, there's the other side of the coin. It's not me who's wanting the divorce. It's him or her. You know, there's countless scenarios you could come up with. And sadly, there are bound to be loads which are very real for many here today, whether that's in your own life or in the life of friends or family or colleagues. So how do we make sense of Jesus' absolute insistence that marriage is for good and yet at the same time engage fully with the realities of 21st century life? Well, the only way we can do this is by just stepping back for a moment and looking at the context in which he's speaking in verses 17 to 20. Now, there's three parts to what he says. Firstly, in verse 17, he's quite clear. Don't be mistaken. I haven't come to abolish the law and the prophets, far from it. And he goes on to emphasize this more fully in verses 18 and 19. So the Old Testament teachings are going to stay exactly the same until this age comes to an end. But he then qualifies what he's just said in the second half of verse 17 when he says, no, I haven't come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. So what does he mean by that? Well, he must be saying that the Old Testament laws are far more than a series of rules and regulations. They point to something more, or more accurately, they point to someone. They point to a Messiah who's going to come to free his people from the penalty of breaking the law. And when understood correctly, the way that that Messiah is going to free his people from the penalty of breaking the law is by paying that penalty himself. And he'll do that by dying on a cross. So here's Jesus starting to explain that, yes, the law is still totally valid as the right way to live life, but because no one other than him is able to fully live up to its standards, he's going to die on a cross so that anyone who truly seeks forgiveness is freed from the penalty of breaking the law. So that's not really saying anything different from what's already been said many times during this whole series on the Ten Commandments. But then we've got the third point here, where he does expand on things a little. Because in verse 20, he says that those who are meant to be the ones who understand the law, that's the Pharisees and teachers of the law, have actually got it horribly wrong. So what were they doing which was so wrong? Well, for starters, whenever there was a suggestion of the slightest ambiguity in the law, they would step in and interpret it. And of course, some of them would say that it meant this, and some of them would say, no, no, it meant that. So inevitably, this meant there were all sorts of debates about how to apply the law. And in the end, what it amounted to was a whole load of legalism, with the teachers arguing their case and trying to justify their point of view. But often, that meant not much more than trying to look good and trying to justify their own actions. So Jesus is saying, no, that's not what the law is all about. It's fulfilled in me, and it points to me. So if you want to know the real meaning of the law, look at me. Don't get caught up in legalism. Following me is so much more than that. So when we start getting drawn into hypothetical discussions about whether in this circumstance or that circumstance divorce may be permissible, beware. Are we starting to live our lives like the Pharisees? You see, we're never, ever going to have everything nice and neatly mapped out. Jesus doesn't allow for that. It's far less than what following him really means. Because being a Christian is actually about following a person and not merely following a series of rules and regulations. It's about the Holy Spirit within enabling me to model Jesus, not just telling people what's right and wrong. So, you know, if a friend comes to me and says, Ian, I'm in a desperate state. My wife's having an affair. What am I going to do? You know, I'm not going to say, oh, that's okay, you're lucky, because if they were just good friends, Matthew 5:32 says you couldn't divorce her. That's nonsense, isn't it? Absolute nonsense. I do need to know what the Bible says, but when the crisis hits, I also need to know what the wise thing is to do and say at that time, in that place, for those people. And sometimes you can do little more than weep with those who weep. So we must beware legalism, generally wrapped up in pride and wanting to be in control or to look good like the Pharisees. And Jesus has no time for it at all. I need to finish. How do we sum it all up? Well, with great difficulty. All of us will have had experience of really tough situations, and many of us may be facing major issues right now, whether that be in your own life or with family, friends, or colleagues. Marriage breakdown is horrible. We all know that. And we've probably experienced it ourselves in some shape or form. And that's why the Bible tells us to be serious about being holy. But the Bible also tells us that there is always hope, however hard that may be to believe. You can't turn the clock back and undo things that have been done, but you can turn to Jesus. In fact, you can only turn to Jesus. Now, I don't know where you all stand today, but if there is anyone here who's in a real mess, then please do turn to Jesus. Whether that's for the first time, or whether you've known him for ages and found yourself wandering away to the point of being lost. Because there is always a way back, but you do need to turn around while you can still do something about it.